Taliban officials say two deadly explosions have hit the Afghan capital, Kabul, with one of them happening in the city's Shia neighborhood. The German chancellor calls the COVID situation in her country dramatic, as France says it is being hit by the fifth wave of the pandemic. And the cost of living in the UK at its highest level in almost a decade, partly driven by higher household energy costs. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Afghan capital of Kabul has been struck by two explosions again, with Taliban sources reporting at least 8 deaths and 15 injuries. The Interior Ministry, in a tweet, said an explosive-laden vehicle ripped through a Shia-majority suburb of Kabul, leaving 1 dead and 6 injured. The second explosion happened elsewhere in the city, but an anonymous Taliban source said the second blast killed 7 people and wounded 9 others. No group or individual has claimed responsibility. Afghanistan has experienced a series of blasts since the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Earlier this week, a Shia-majority neighborhood in the capital was rocked by an explosion. Last month, 2 Shia mosques were also hit by suicide Daesh bombers that left over 120 worshippers dead. Tehran has urged members of the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from making hasty comments with political purposes about Iran's nuclear issue. The remark came from the caretaker of Iran's UN mission in Vienna. That after the IAEA, in a report, criticized the Islamic Republic for not granting its inspectors access to reinstall surveillance cameras at a nuclear facility in the city of Karaj near Tehran. Mohammad Reza Ghaibi said Iran regards the agency's access to the centrifuge parts workshop beyond its legal obligations. He said that this is because the Karaj site is still under judicial and security investigations following a terror attack, which Iran blamed on Israel. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna-based correspondent, Homolesky. She says Iran has already blamed the West and the IAEA for remaining silent on the terror attack against the Karaj nuclear facility.
Now, this is the same facility that came under what Iran called the terrorist or sabotage attack, widely blamed on Israel back in June. And the previous head of Iran's, the previous Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Mr. Gharib Abadi, whose term in office here in Vienna has now come to an end. He had previously asked the agency to clearly and in clear words condemn this terrorist act that's been committed, he said, by Israel. And the fact that the agency has not done so, he said, shows that the Europeans, the Americans, and the IAEA have decided to remain silent on these sabotage attempts. And he was saying that you cannot expect Iran to give the agency access, to give the agency the storage of the camera that was destroyed in an attack by Israel, and at the same time remain silent about this attack and not to condemn the perpetrator of this attack. Iran says that it's still investigating, its security and judicial officials are still investigating the matter, and they want to see if, in fact, Israel did use the IAEA cameras in order to carry out the
Iran has marked the 10th martyrdom anniversary of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, known as the father of Iran's missile program, who based the country's defense strategy on missile capabilities. Saman Khujuri reports.
Iran has commemorated the 10th martyrdom anniversary of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, a general known for his relentless efforts to develop Iran's missile program. Senior military and state officials attended the ceremony to honor the lofty status of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam and his unique role in the missile program of the country. Tehrani Moghaddam, an IRGC commander, was a key figure in Iran's ballistic missile program. He helped develop the medium and long-range ballistic missiles. An engineer by profession, he designed the Shahab, Qadr, and Sejil missiles with a range of over 1,000 kilometers. Tehrani Moghaddam began establishing the Iran missile program at the time when the country was under attacks during the 8-year Iraq-imposed war on Iran. He continued his efforts to boost the program in subsequent years amid the difficulties and shortages.
He was truly the father of missile program of the country. Today, Iran's missile industry and its mass production, from the safe missile towns to the development of sophisticated missiles with precise targeting, are all fruits of the efforts made by Tehrani Moghaddam and his colleagues. This has boosted Iran's defensive capability.
Tehwani Mukaddam was killed in an explosion in November 2011 west of Tehran. The blast came during a missile test at a base in Bidgene. At least 16 others were killed in the blast.
Iran's missile program is part of the regional power of Iran, which is to ensure peace, stability, and security in the region. Iran's missile power has never posed any threat to regional countries. Stability is a legacy left behind by Tehrani Mukaddam for the country and the region. Therefore, Iran's missile program is never up for negotiations because this is the fruit of the sacrifices made by our dear martyrs.
As observers say, the West's efforts to stop Iran's missile program over the past years reveal the significance of Tehrani Mukaddam's legacy, which serves as Iran's main power of deterrence.
Tehrani Mukaddam has based Iran's defense strategy on missile capabilities and missile deterrence, a move that effectively removed any military option against the country from the table of the enemies. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Israeli regime continues to break international laws on an almost daily basis, and even though Palestinians have remained steadfast in their opposition and resistance to Israeli policies that have been compared to policies under an apartheid regime, the international community has failed them all along. Laws devised to stop Israel from violating Palestinian rights, like settlement buildings, have repeatedly been broken. And now Israel is cooking up a new scheme, building a new neighborhood in an illegal settlement.
Israel is planning to seize more land from Palestinians. The Israelis are planning to build a new neighborhood in the illegal settlement of Ariel. The new neighborhood is set to be built some 2 kilometers away from the settlement's main residential area. The construction would impede the future expansion of the Palestinian town of Salfit. First phase of the new neighborhood includes 730 residential units. The construction of Ariel settlement itself was first approved 30 years ago. The 730 residential units planned for the West Ariel in the first phase are part of the plan that Israeli authorities announced last month to build about 1,300 new homes and settlements. An additional plan for West Ariel was approved in the 1990s.
The Israelis consider they have a right to expand their settlements whenever they see fit. And Palestinians, they say, officially have no rights, no democratic rights inside Palestine in terms of their recent Israeli nation state law, so peace is completely impossible.
If it goes ahead, an additional 800 residential units could be built. Israel's plans to build new settlements come amid rising attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their properties. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, in its latest report covering the period of October 5 through October 18, documented settlers' actions, which included damaging over 1,600 trees, most of them olive trees, or stealing Palestinians' harvest. These attacks took place in villages neighboring the cities of Nablus, Al-Khalil, Safit, Ramallah, and Al-Quds.
The Zionists have, from the very beginning, refused to negotiate in any serious way with the Palestinians. They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians until they can be expelled. That's been consistent from the beginning until today.
The Fourth Committee of the UN General Assembly recently approved several anti-Israel resolutions covering multiple issues, from settlement buildings to the expulsion of Palestinian families and the demolition of their homes. One UN official has even described the construction of settlements as a war crime. Still, the Tel Aviv remains defiant. And recently, Israel's UN envoy went as far as tearing up a Human Rights Council report at the General Assembly.
More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. Israel has expanded its settlements on Palestinian territories over the years. Israel has many plans to expand other illegal settlements, including building 470 housing units in Pisgat Zeev, almost 200 buildings in Ramat Shlomo, and 500 housing units in Har Homa. After former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in December 2016, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which pronounces settlements in the West Bank and outlets a flagrant violation under international law. The administration of U.S. President Biden has practically done nothing to stop Israel's expansionist policies.
Now, the difference between Trump, the monstrous predecessor, and Biden is that Trump openly gloated at Israeli successes and insulted Palestinians at every opportunity. He was playing to his white supremacist electoral base. It's different for Biden. He's in the Democratic Party. But nonetheless, he's still a spokesman for corporate America, and he represents continuity with Obama and also continuity with Trump in a way, because the Israeli embassy, which the American embassy, which Trump moved to Jerusalem, remains in Jerusalem. It's continuity with American policy towards Israel since 1967.
The Biden administration appears neither willing nor interested in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law as they are built on occupied land. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital.
The COVID-19 pandemic continues to wreak havoc across Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting a record increase in their daily cases and deaths. The French government spokesperson says the country is being hit by a fifth wave of COVID infections. Gabriel Attal noted that Paris is not planning extra measures to fight the virus. In Russia, officials report about 1,250 deaths, a new one-day record for the country. Also, over 36,000 new daily cases were logged. The Czech Republic is another European country struggling with an uptick in infections. Health officials there reported more than 22,000 new cases, the highest daily tally since the pandemic began. Meanwhile, the German chancellor warns of a dramatic coronavirus situation in her country.
The present pandemic situation is dramatic. I can't put it any other way. The fourth wave has hit our country with full force. And even though there is no more legal ground for the pandemic national emergency situation, I have no doubt that we are in the midst of such an emergency situation.
Merkel also said that the upward trend in COVID cases, fatalities, and patients being taken to intensive care units is, quote, frightening. The chancellor also pointed out the country's urgent need to progress on vaccinations. The official cumulative number of infections in Germany has now surpassed 5,144,000, while the death toll stands at over 98,000. Hospitals in many European countries are filled with patients and health systems struggling to cope with the crisis. Britons are paying a lot more for food, fuel, and accommodation, with the country's inflation rate surging to a 10-year high last month. The annual rate has jumped to 4.2%. That's the highest level since November 2011. And that's more than double the target set by the Bank of England. Increased household energy bills, a rise in the cost of secondhand cars and fuel, and higher prices in restaurants and hotels are blamed for the surge. The reported spike in inflation prompted a drop in UK stocks compared to their European peers on Wednesday. Earlier we talked to our correspondent in London, Syed Purusa, who told us more about the reasons behind the rising inflation in the United Kingdom.
These numbers mean that the inflation rate has risen and it's probably going to continue rising. This, of course, comes months after a warning from the Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey, who said that the inflation rate was going to rise in the coming months, but that it would be temporary, although there are a lot of other people who are saying that it will not be temporary. But how did we get here? The reasons can be sought in many different places. Some are related to the pandemic, others are not related to the pandemic. Some are a direct result of Brexit. For example, we saw the shortage of those semiconductor microchips that are used in cars, in smartphones, washing machines, and a lot of the other stuff that we use on a daily basis. And then in September, we had the truck driver shortages, a direct result of Brexit, those European drivers who left post-Brexit, never to come back.
Bleak winter ahead for Europeans. The continent is battling a record-breaking surge in natural gas prices amid a severe energy crunch. The price of gas in the Netherlands for next month is now over 101 euros per megawatt hour, the highest since October the 18th. This follows reports that Germany's energy regulator had suspended the approval process for a major new pipeline, Nord Stream 2, bringing Russian gas into Europe. The increase in energy costs has already pushed up inflation in several European countries. The crisis is said to be driven by other factors as well, including a gradual phasing out of coal, as well as higher demand due to the lifting of coronavirus-related restrictions in several countries. An envoy of the Venezuelan government was kidnapped last year in the African island of Cape Verde on a U.S. arrest warrant. Alex Saab was extradited to the United States last month to face trial on corruption allegations. We have reached out to his wife, Camilla Fabre, to hear more about Saab's condition. She is very critical of the way that her husband was treated by the Cape Verde government.
The experience of him in Cape Verde was horrific, horrible, and he was tortured every single day, not only physical but also psychologist torture. Also, Alex is a survivor of cancer. The government of Cabo Verde never authorized the access of his medical of medical specialist to see him.
Fabi says the treatment came despite calls by international organizations to release Saab or to stop his extradition. She says that Saab was an envoy on a humanitarian mission and his political immunity had to be respected. But the Cape Verde government was ignorant of all of that and preferred to collaborate with the U.S. Fabi believes this was all set up to pile pressure on the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and to oust him from power. On Monday, Saab pleaded not guilty in a federal court in the U.S., after a judge drops several money laundering charges against him. He is now facing a single charge. Caracas calls Saab's detention a kidnapping case. It has also suspended the talks with the opposition on ending the political crisis in Venezuela. Saab was a member of that negotiating team. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. Its ambition was clear. The United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, was meant to secure a deal to give the world a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change by capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. The article you're about to hear has been written by Reuters news agency journalist Kate Abnett, Valerie Volkovici, Richard Valdmanis, and Barbara Lewis. The piece is titled, Was Glasgow Pact a Win for Climate? Time will tell. Its ambition was clear. The United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, was meant to secure a deal to give the world a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change by capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, that is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. The accord met that bar, but just barely, and its ultimate success will be determined by the future actions of the governments that thrashed it out, according to the summit's UK hosts, participants and observers. I think today we can say with credibility that we've kept the 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach, but its pulse is weak and we will only survive if we keep our promises, the summit's president, Alok Sharma, said late on Saturday after the pact was adopted. The deal, backed by nearly 200 countries, for the first time explicitly targeted fossil fuels, the biggest driver of man-made global warming, asked governments to accelerate emissions cuts, and promised more money for poor countries struggling with climate change. It also ushered in voluntary pledges and pacts from countries, companies and investors to clean up emissions from cars and from planes, curb the powerful greenhouse gas methane, protect forests, and bolster green finance. But the agreement was packed with compromises, leaving all sides, from wealthy nations seeking faster action to resource-rich developing countries and low-lying island states, dissatisfied. The approved texts are a compromise, said United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres. They reflect the interests, the conditions, the contradictions, and the state of political will in the world today. That leaves the world highly vulnerable. We are still knocking on the door of climate catastrophe. It is time to go into emergency mode, Antonio Guterres said. The summit did not deliver enough emissions-cutting pledges from countries to set a clear path to limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Instead, it struck a deal for the nearly 200 countries represented at the event to increase their pledges next year to close the gap. But the gap is huge. Governments' current pledges to cut emissions this decade would lead to a 2.4 degrees Celsius rise in temperature, in global warming terms. To align with the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, that's the target, countries need to cut carbon dioxide emissions by 45% by 2030 from 2010 levels. Under current pledges, emissions would rise by nearly 14% by 2030. While compromises at COP26 keep the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise target within reach, it is hanging by a thread, said Bert Wander, the acting chief executive officer of environmental group Avaaz. China, the world's biggest carbon dioxide emitter, announced in a joint declaration with the United States last week that it would accelerate efforts to reduce emissions by curbing coal use, tackling methane, and preserving forests. It provided few details, however. China was also among a group of resource-rich developing countries that watered down language targeting fossil fuels in the text of the Glasgow deal. The draft called on countries to phase out coal use and fossil fuel subsidies. But as the negotiations played out in Glasgow, words were changed. Coal became unabated coal, leaving scope for continued use of coal that uses emissions capturing technology. Subsidies became inefficient subsidies, without a definition of which types of subsidies counted as inefficient, providing wriggle room for governments to continue funding oil, gas, and coal. A last-minute intervention by India and China just before the pact was adopted in Glasgow also changed the requested coal phase-out to a phase-down. The Glasgow Agreement delivered a mixed bag on finance, a contentious issue between poor countries and their richer and powerful counterparts. Finance boils down to the issue of fairness and whether rich countries whose historical emissions are largely responsible for causing climate change will pay the costs of its imposing on the world's poorest countries. The deal made some headway. It asked developed countries to at least double their collective provision of climate finance for adaptation to developing countries' parties from 2019 levels by 2025. It also, for the first time, made mention of loss and damage in the cover section of the agreement. Loss and damage refers to the costs countries are already facing from climate-driven disasters, for which those countries have for years sought compensation. But after resistance from the United States of America, the European Union, and other rich industrialized countries, the accord failed to secure funds for that compensation. The world's most vulnerable countries backed the final deal grudgingly in Glasgow. The negotiator from Antigua and Barbuda, Leah Nicholson, said her country and other small island states at the talks in Glasgow will express our grievances in due course. Rich industrialized countries broke a 2009 promise to deliver $100 billion annually by 2020 in climate finance, making poor countries wary that promised cash will not arrive. They now expect to deliver the $100 billion by 2023.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
فَقَدْ قَالَ اللَّهُ الْحَكِيمُ فِي كِتَابِهِ الْمُبِينِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْتَرِي لَهْوَ الْحَدِيثِ لِيُذِلَّ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ وَيَتَّخِذَهَا هُزُوًا أُولَئِكَ لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ مُحِينٌ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ. My dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are looking at the theme of dealing with temporal strife through living a Quranic life. How to understand the challenges that you and I face in this world, this upside down world that we live in, where things, as much as we think, you know, that things are going normal, that things get turned upside down for us, as we see happening with COVID-19 around the world today. How do we deal with such difficulties and even the personal challenges that we face within our lives? In this series, we've been wanting to look at all of the different, or look at many of the difficulties rather that we face, and to draw inspiration from Kalamullah, the noble Quran, the words of Allah, of how we can deal with the difficulties in our lives. To realize that this book of Allah is not just a book to read in beginning of a majlis, or at a funeral, or at a wedding, or in special occasions, but rather that we as believers begin to take an active role in reading and reflecting and understanding and trying to implement the ayat of the Quran in our daily lives. Because as we've said from the very first night, that this book contains answers for all of our problems. We just need to look at the book in the right way, with the right vision, with the right understanding, and we will get the answers that we are searching for in life. Tonight we look at our topic of entertainment, the Quranic perspective on permissible and impermissible. The verse which I began with comes to us from a very beautiful chapter of the Quran known as Surah Luqman, chapter number 31, verse number 6. Now, let me just mention one or two things about Luqman. He's a very interesting character if you get a chance to study about him. He was, as we have been told in the hadith, a man from Africa. He was given an opportunity by Allah to either take nubuwwah, prophethood, or hikmah, wisdom, to become a wise man. And he passed up the opportunity for nubuwwah, and he was given this level of hikmah. And Allah makes note of this even in the Quran, where he says, وَلَكَدْ أَتَيْنَا لُقْمَانَ Al-Hikmah, that Allah says that we have given Luqman wisdom, hikmah. And the chapter, actually a very beautiful chapter, again it's a discussion that he has with his young son, where he gives his son lots of advice on how to live life. And it shows us even as believers, and especially as parents, as the fathers who are watching tonight, the role of a father in upbringing his children. The way that he talks to his son, the advice that he gives him, the discussions that he has with his young child. In one of the verses, in verse number 6, Allah gives forth this very important commandment for us. Let me first go into why this verse was revealed. As we know that the Quran, the ayat, come down for certain reasons. Things were happening in Mecca or in Medina, which necessitated Allah to reveal ayat to the Prophet to explain the situation further for the community. So we're told that there was an individual in Medina who was a believer, he was apparently a Muslim, and he went out and he bought a slave girl as a woman that would be in his house to provide entertainment as a singer, as a dancer. Obviously, they didn't have, you know, television and the things like that that we have today. And so you would go in the market, and yes, slavery existed at the time of the Prophet. It was a slow process to eradicate it. So he purchases a slave woman from the market, and her responsibility was to provide entertainment at home, to sing, to dance for him. And this obviously is something which not only is haram, And we look at that in our discussion tonight about certain issues about the permissible and impermissible. But this was something obviously that was keeping him away from the remembrance of Allah, as entertainment many times does even to you and I today. And so this verse comes down to Rasulullah, which says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ, and of the people, مَنْ يَشْتَرِي لَحْوَ الْحَدِيثِ لِيُذِلَّ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. And amongst the people is somebody who purchases this idle talk, this diversionary talk, which leads people astray from the Quran, from Allah, from all things holy. So they are purchasing, they are using money, they are going forth and expending time and resources to misguide, not only themselves, but other people from the path of Allah. بِغَيْرِ إِلْمٍ وَيَتَّخِذَهَا هُزُوًا, that they take the Quran for mockery, as a joke. أُولَٰئِكَ لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ, Allah says for them is a shameful, humiliating punishment. So this verse comes down to show the Prophet and the believers that look, this diversionary tactic that is being used of entertainment, of pleasure, this was something which was looked very badly upon by Allah within the Quran. And the believers were made known in those days that, you know what? That this act of going towards the prohibited, to misguide people, to distance people from Allah, that this is something which is not allowed in Islam. It has consequences, it has ramifications, and it also has obviously a punishment in the world to come. Now with that, let me go into the introduction for tonight. And it's a very vast discussion. I'm going to try and keep it very focused for tonight. But you know, we live in a society today, especially brothers and sisters, where from before our birth all the way up until our death, we are surrounded by enjoyment, pleasure, fun, entertainment. You know, if you think about it, we have the hadith that Rasulullah says, seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave. Today, that rather than seeking knowledge, talibul ilm, utlubul ilm min al-mahdi ila lahad, people are seeking entertainment from the cradle to the grave. What do I mean? Well, you look at the society that we live in today, and when a woman is pregnant with her children, with her child, many times you'll see this on, and you'll read this on news articles, or you'll see it on television, that the mother will, for example, sing songs to the baby. The mother will be on her tablet or her phone or on television watching things on the internet, and they're forms of entertainment for her, but the child in the womb is taking this information in. You may think, well, that's preposterous. How does the fetus that's still developing at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months in the womb, how can it actually react or understand things around it that is outside of its world that it's contained in? And this is a reality that you can look it up online, that you know, the fetus does respond to outside stimulus. And that's why we're told in Islam for mothers that you have to be extra careful when you're pregnant of what you look at, what you listen to, what you eat, where you go, because all of these have an impact on the child. So, as I said, that we begin as a society that is steeped in fun, in pleasure, in entertainment from pre-birth until we're born. Then, you know, we have stores like Babies R Us, like Toys R Us. Our children get caught up in games as a child, as a baby, as an infant, and they grow and they continue in that way. And as they get older, their toys get a bit more advanced, as we spoke about yesterday. And this continues all the way until we die. We're always surrounded by fun, by pleasure. You go shopping, you go into the mall, you go into the store, there is music playing. You go in an elevator, there is music playing. You go anywhere today, at school, at work, there's always some form of fun or entertainment or music to keep us busy in different ways. So we're not saying that we cut out entertainment from our lives. No, we're saying that we need to understand what is permissible. Why is it permissible? We have to understand what is haram, what is impermissible. Why is it impermissible?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صابر مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Israel, as policy, fully supports and assists settler intimidation tactics that often result in the loss of Palestinian farm and pasture land, says Israeli rights group. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Middle East Eye. This article is titled, "The Zionist Regime Uses Settler Violence as Tool to Take Palestinian Land." Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime has been using settler violence as a major informal tool to take over Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, a leading Israeli rights group has found. Betzalem, in a report released recently, said that Israel uses two main methods to confiscate Palestinian land in the West Bank: official annexation via its judicial system and unofficial acts of intimidation and violence carried out by settler population. The state fully supports and assists these acts of violence, and its agents sometimes participate in them directly, the Israeli rights group said in its report. As such, settler violence is a form of policy aided and abetted by official authorities with their active participation. According to the report, Israeli settlers have taken over 11 square miles of farm and pasture land in the occupied West Bank during the past 5 years. Using 5 case studies to illustrate how continuous systematic violence meted out by settlers is part of the Israeli regime's official policy. Betzalem said Israel is using settler violence to drive a massive takeover of Palestinian land. One of the case studies documented an illegal outpost known as Ma'on Farm, which was erected illegally in the southern West Bank and consists of about 1 square miles of land. Settlers have harassed, beaten, and otherwise intimidated the Palestinians that have historically used the land for pasture and farming, resulting in confiscation. Juma Rabi, a 40-year-old shepherd from Al-Tawani village, told Betzalem that settlers had been, for years, working to push his family off the farming that sustains them. In 2018, settlers attacked and beat Rabi, leaving him with severe injuries. He told the rights group, "They broke my leg and I had to spend 2 weeks in hospital and continue treatment at home. I had to sell most of our sheep to cover the cost of treatment." According to Betzalem, Israel legitimizes settler violence both by legalizing their informal land grabs and by failing to even attempt to prevent or prosecute such violence. Betzalem found the military avoids confronting violent settlers as a matter of policy, although soldiers have the authority and duty to detain and arrest them. As a rule, the military prefers to remove Palestinians from their own farmland or pasture land rather than confront settlers, using various tactics such as issuing closed military zone orders that apply to Palestinians only, or firing tear gas, stun grenades, rubber-coated metal bullets, and even live rounds. It continued, "Sometimes soldiers actively participate in the settler attacks or look on from the sidelines." Muayyad Besharat, programs and project manager at the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, told Middle East Eye that settler attacks against Palestinians have increased this year, particularly during the olive harvest season, which runs between October and November. The olive harvest is a lifeline for some 80,000 to 100,000 Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. This year's season has been the hardest in recent memory, according to Besharat, who accompanies farmers during harvest as an observer. Echoing Betzalem's report, Besharat underlined the difficulty Palestinians face in attempting to combat settler attacks and land grabs, given the frequency in which settlers are accompanied by army escorts. While Palestinians regularly document and report settler attacks, both legally and via tools such as books, research reports, and documentaries, the Israeli regime almost never takes legal action against settlers. Israel's inaction continues after settler attacks on Palestinians have taken place, with enforcement authorities doing their utmost to avoid responding to these incidents, Betzalem wrote, adding, "Complaints are difficult to file, and in the very few cases in which investigations are in fact opened, the system quickly whitewashes them. Indictments are hardly ever filed against settlers who harm Palestinians, and when they do, usually cite minor offenses with token penalties to match in the rare instance of a conviction. The group found, in all, the lack of action has translated into de facto approval. It said, state violence, official and otherwise, is part and parcel of Israel's apartheid regime, which aims to create a Jewish-only space between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. The combination of violence, nominally unofficial violence, allows Israel to have it both ways, maintain plausible deniability and blame the violence on settler rather than on the military, the courts or civil administration, while advancing Palestinian disposition. The facts, however, blow plausible deniability out of the water. When the violence occurs with permission and assistance from the Israeli authorities and under its auspices, it is state violence. The settlers are not defying the state, they are doing its bidding, it said.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The enemy's efforts to promote the idea that Islam should not interfere in matters related to anything besides the individual.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24th, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Islam is an all-inclusive religion, and we should act in accordance with this all-inclusiveness. This is one issue. Another issue is the issue of Muslims' unity. These two issues are among the most important issues of our day. Of course, there are numerous important issues at the present time, and these two issues are among the most important ones. Regarding the issue of acting in accordance with the all-inclusiveness of Islam, there has been an insistent effort, mainly on the part of political and materialistic powers, to reduce Islam to matters related to the individual and belief only. This effort has existed for a long time. I cannot specify a certain date and say that such efforts started from that date, but from about 100 or 100 plus years ago, this effort has been pronounced in the Islamic world. This effort has doubled after the formation of the Islamic Republic.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They also try to make it look like it is not a political effort and make it look like an intellectual effort. As the Westerners say, they have tried to theorize it. Thinkers, writers, activists, and the like are commissioned to write about this and prove that Islam has nothing to do with social matters, matters concerning life and fundamental issues regarding humanity, that Islam is a belief of the heart, and that it is a personal relationship with God and a series of individual actions based on this relationship only. They introduce this as Islam. They insist on proving this in the minds of their audience.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.